Hey everyone, thanks for listening to my podcasts here on the Hullerstubber feed. Do spread the word to other people if you think they might enjoy them. Do listen to some more if you think you might enjoy them, but do enjoy this one. I am shortly going to be on tour with my new stand-up show, Can I Have My Ball Back? Head to richardherring.com/ballback/tour for all those dates. Some of them are sold out, some of them have hardly sold anything. It would really help me if you bought tickets to the ones that aren't sold out. Either way, as soon as you can. I think it's going to be a lot of fun. It's about cancer and testicles. One of them's not funny, but one of them's really funny, and it kind of cancels out the unfunniness. I'd say just on average, slightly more funny. So I hope you'll come along. If not, keep enjoying the podcast. We'll be back in September at the Leicester Square Theatre with more live podcasts. Maybe a few Edinburgh ones before then. Sit back, relax, and enjoy this stupid podcast you've chosen to listen to.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello, my fine friends. Welcome to another very exciting Hullerstubber book club. This week we are talking to Sam Knight about his book, The Premonitions Bureau. Hello, Sam. How are you doing?
Yeah, not bad. Yeah, thank you.
First of all, who are you, Sam? And else have you written before this book?
Okay. So this is my first. This is my first book. I write for The New Yorker, which is, you know, big American magazine. I've been doing that for, I guess, kind of 3 or 4 years. And my job for them is to write about Britain for, you know, an international, you know, primarily an American audience. I guess the thing about The New Yorker, they're really long articles. We take a few months over them, which is an amazing kind of luxury to have these days. And I guess my work tends to divide between about half the time covering quite kind of meat and potatoes, what's going on in these, you know, benighted isles, and the other half I sort of have a bit more latitude to sort of explore things that come my way or sort of don't have a particularly obvious purpose to them.
Okay, and so this book began, is that right, as one of the articles you were writing, is that correct?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no, it started very much as a kind of me seeing the words, you know, the Premonitions Bureau in a pretty random book in the British Library many years ago, and then sort of over the years would sort of be researching it a bit in my spare time, and then finally convinced the magazine to sort of to write a story about it, and it grew from there.
And so tell us in your own words what the book is about exactly.
Yeah, so the Premonitions Bureau was an experiment that ran in Britain in the mid-1960s, quite a kind of concentrated period of time from the autumn of 1966 to the summer of 1968. And it was the idea of a psychiatrist called John Barker, who was a fascinating figure. On the one hand, he was a pretty progressive, researching psychiatrist. He was the deputy superintendent of a large mental hospital outside Shrewsbury. He was sort of, psychiatry at that time was sort of full of ideas, you know, terrible problems as well, but kind of a field that was changing rapidly, and he was pretty at the forefront of that. But at the same time, he had a very, you know, not that unusual, but fairly unusual, you know, mid-20th century British fascination for ghosts or the occult or the kind of the unusual workings of time. So he managed to sort of have these two parts of his personality sort of rubbing alongside each other. And he became convinced that some people could see the future. They could see things before they happened. And so he came up with this idea of, let's try and collect as many dreams and visions and forebodings from the British public as possible, and see if we could use those to prevent disasters.
Sure. And I suppose what's interesting is there's often, obviously, this is a subject that has been covered a lot by non-scientific people, generally there's a bit of hokum and bunkum around it, but this was a sort of an academic approach, really, and he was, which is fair enough. These things should be investigated, whether they're true or not. So he was coming at it more of an academic angle.
Yeah, I mean, I think he would definitely say that, and he was, determined to enlarge the field of psychiatry. I think he thought it was too limited on sort of mental illness and things very much kind of located in the mind. And he kind of argued on a kind of broad range of fronts to have a sort of a more kind of holistic view of kind of psychiatry and mental health. So he would definitely say that he was approaching it as a doctor and as a scientist, but nonetheless, even if there was more tolerance for things like, parapsychology or the occult in the mid 60s, even when he was doing the experiment, he was taking abuse from other doctors. He was getting told off by his superiors and local, NHS officials. At the time, this was something that was kind of uncomfortable, and lots of people would have said, this isn't being pursued with proper, scientific rigor, simply because, it's pretty difficult to do that.
So yeah, well, it's a really interesting book. I mean, it is interesting to it's fascinating to sort of see Britain at that time. I think from your journalistic point of view, it's a very good summing up. Obviously, starting with the Aberfan disaster mainly as the starting point, and whether that could be predicted and whether people had predicted that or not. But you get a real feel, and there's a few sort of diversions off as well. from you, I think, where we're sort of exploring the 60s as much as the Premonitions Bureau. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think it is. And I had a wonderful time researching it. The Premonitions Bureau was this experiment sort of led by Barker, but done very much in collaboration with a man called Peter Fairley, who was the science editor of the Evening Standard newspaper. And while he was helping to collect all the premonitions from the public, which came into the Evening Standard's newsroom, he would be off in Cape Canaveral, kind of watching the testing of the Jupiter rockets to carry, astronauts to the moon, or writing about, hovercraft or lasers. He was a real sort of figure of, discovery and excitement, and doing the research. I spent quite a lot of time in the archives of Shelton Hospital, which is this mental hospital outside Shrewsbury, but also, tracking down old timers from the Evening Standard from the 60s and trying to sort of get, I got a guy to sort of draw out the original floor plan of the newsroom, and tried to sort of get as much as I could in touch with the sort of, the sounds and the smells and the kind of the feel of it all. So no, I love trying to sort of evoke that very particular period of time where there was just a huge amount of technological change and social change, and on some level a feeling that many, many things were possible. And I don't know whether that expands the sense of things that maybe look more impossible to us these days.
Yeah, I suppose what I found interesting, and maybe this is true of the 60s generally, in a lot of ways, Aberfan is, obviously a terrible tragedy, and you're very eloquently and almost dispassionately, actually, in a journalistic way, describe what went on. And it's horrible. I think a lot of modern people might not be quite aware of exactly what happened at Aberfan, but that feels like a thing from the past, coal mines and slag heaps, and it feels very 40s or 50s or 30s even. And then obviously the 60s is also full of this space race and aeroplanes and politics moving forwards. And so I think this, the 60s does seem to encapsulate this. The start of the 60s feels like the 40s or the 50s, and the end of the 60s feels like a very different world that we're in.
No, I agree with you. Yeah,
good. you don't really come down on any, I think you're correctly, I suppose, trying to maintain a open mind about this and not really come down in, on either side. Do you think the Premonitions Bureau had any real success? Or, I mean, do you think it's possible to see the future? Did you end up feeling that or not?
So I have quite a few things to say about this. I mean, I suppose the first thing that I kind of kept in my mind is that when it seems to me, it's when we're told stories about the occult or the paranormal, you know, there is normally a pretty strong agenda either way why we're being told that information, and it's normally to sort of desperately convince you that there's something out there, or it's done to sort of demolish things and show how, you know, irrational the human mind is and prone to confirmation bias and seeing things that aren't there, and sort of, you know, very maybe a sense that this kind of thinking is harmful or delusional in some way. And I really wanted to write this story without a strong agenda, which I think is the kind of reporting and writing you get about many other subjects, you know. So I was keen to sort of try and write a history, if you know what I mean, a kind of closely observed little social history of this experiment and the people who were involved in it, and to try and write about, you know, their experience. And in a sense, leave it there. And, you know, maybe that sounds like a bit of a cop-out. I mean, but I suppose my justifications for doing that would be, on the one hand, I have not in my life ever experienced a premonition in the way that, you know, I describe, you know, the visions that kind of occupied the Premonitions Bureau, but I don't see how we can see things before they happen. You know, time moves in one direction. You know, physics is pretty solid on this. So I have no reason to see these things as anything other than amazing coincidences that had a lot of significance for the people who witnessed them and who sort of and experienced them. But on the other hand, you know, I'm not a religious person either, but I kind of just note the way that occult beliefs or superstitious beliefs or impossible things like premonitions are often marginalized, whereas to my mind other realms of supernatural thinking, believing in, you know, gods or prayer or other things are kind of they're treated differently in our culture often, and I'm not sure there's an entirely logical reason why that is. I think there are cultural reasons why that is, but I'm not sure there's an obvious rational reason for sort of elevating one type of magical thinking above another, if you know what I mean.
No, I'm a very skeptical person, but I would love all this stuff to be true equally. I've always been fascinated. I mean, as a kid, I was always fascinated with Nostradamus and stuff like that. And so there's a part, you know, there's a few of the, you know, there's a couple of the people that send their stuff into the Premonitions Bureau who seem to have some good hits, but I don't know how many misses they also had. I think the one about the Russian astronaut seems fairly strong, though again, I suppose that was so zeitgeist that if you were dreaming, you would dream of astronauts and dreams, the kind of dreams you would have where someone would be trapped and crashing and dying. But
all of that.
There are a few that do feel closer. But then, you know, a lot of them, I mean, you address this in the book, obviously the problem with a premonition, it's not any use unless it's very specific and can point you to exactly what's going to happen, which obviously none of them really do. And if it does that, then it won't come true because you'll stop it. So it won't be a premonition. So it's this sort of circular argument. So the idea of the Premonitions Bureau was partly set up to try and see if they could predict disasters and prevent them. But obviously, even if that had worked, which it clearly didn't, it sort of wouldn't have worked as well. Its success would have been its own failure. So it's trapped in this logical paradox, isn't it?
No, definitely. And that's something that Barker wrestled with. He wasn't sort of unaware of all the problems, except for perhaps, you know, the main problem that this is, you know, on the face of it, impossible. But he was, you know, occupied by this paradox of, if you can stop something from happening, therefore, you know, how can you possibly have a vision of it? And he was aware of the skepticism, and he was aware of the kind of the professional, you know, embarrassment or opprobrium kind of involved in undertaking something like this. And yet he went ahead with it anyway. And likewise, Fairley, you know, who presented the moon landings on ITV and was kind of becoming quite a kind of, you know, known media personality in this part of the 60s, also didn't see a conflict with covering the biggest scientific stories of the time and pursuing these questions. I think these were the things that I guess there were two things. Like, these were the kind of outlooks or the kind of worldviews that I found really interesting. It's always irresistible when someone can see all the reasons why not to do something and they kind of do it anyway. There's something kind of, I find, intrinsically pretty fascinating about that. And then I guess the other thing that I found that sort of sustained me, you know, you sort of mentioned earlier, the book sort of, it tells the story of the experiment, but it also kind of steps out from that. And there are some sort of, you know, brief visits into, you know, a bit of, you know, very light neuroscience, a bit of history of prophecies, some stuff about, you know, second sight in the Western Isles of Scotland and things like that, trying to sort of, if you like, I hope, give information to readers to sort of understand or sort of enrich their sense of what's happening. But one of the things that really kind of, not exactly like kept me going, but I keep kind of returning to when I think about this, is this idea in neuroscience, which has been, you know, around and sort of gaining more momentum since the early 1990s, of this idea that our brains are driven by predicting what's going to happen next. Like, we don't experience things or sensations from the outside world as they happen to us. Our brains are always reaching forward using our memories or past experiences or the environment that we've grown up in to shape what's happening to us. And I love the way that premonitions and predictions kind of blur into a very natural way of making experience for ourselves. You know, we see things and make connections and make correlations constantly. That's kind of how we survive. And therefore kind of premonitions are just this, like, this one step beyond that are very, very enticing and kind of, you know, always have been. There's always been this role for prophets and people who can at least claim to see the next thing coming.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
On Formative, middle school kids from New York City public schools interview a phenomenal collection of grown-ups.
Me, like, I don't know what I want to do.
You don't have to have all the answers.
I feel like a lot of people's favorite topics are, like, interest in their life.
That is a really good answer.
The podcast where the leaders of today are interviewed by leaders of tomorrow. Listen now at newyorkedge.org/formative or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
So, yeah, I mean, I suppose what's interesting about the art, if premonitions are true and they do work, even if they can't help us stop things happening, it does have a lot of implications for the nature of time and fate, I suppose. If we can predict the future, then the future is sort of set, isn't it? So that means nothing we do has any purpose. What would you think about that if premonitions are true?
strong stuff. These aren't sort of new questions and dilemmas for us. Where do I start with this? I mean, I feel like, you know, in the people I was writing about, they experienced or thought they were experiencing glimpses, right? You know, a little moment where, for whatever kind of, you know, crossed wire kind of out there, you have impossible knowledge, if you know what I mean. And I don't, certainly in terms of kind of Barker and the main, you know, percipients, as he called them, you know, the people who are having these visions. Yes, there's like big ramifications for time and the future being simultaneous with the present and all sorts of kind of mind-bending ideas. But I think what really they thought they were onto was actually more of an idea of a kind of a shared subconscious, you know, if you know what I mean. Like this, Barker in particular was sort of influenced by, you know, Jung and J.B. Priestley and other people who were kind of really occupied by questions of time and a sort of a collective, you know, a shared consciousness. And I say, and the idea that, you know, if I can see something that's gonna happen to you before it happens, or you can see me over, you know, Barker often talked about twins. And, you know, if something happens to a twin, you know, they have an accident and like 300 miles away, the other twin gets a sort of a pain in their knee or something like that. A lot of us, despite our kind of conscious rationalism, would sort of think, yeah, kind of fair enough. You know, is that, I don't really know how that would be possible. I also wouldn't exclude that from being possible. And Barker's sort of logic was, he called it, you know, the sympathetic projection of pain. If that could happen between two people across distance, you know, would it be possible for that to happen across time? And even like hearing the words coming out of my mouth, that's nonsense. But on the other hand, it's also something that is also intuitively, like, I think, recognizable to many people in their experience. Like, it's been, you know, fun working on this because people's, you know, sometimes say, oh, you know, what are you working on? And you tell them, you know, as briefly as you can, like what it is. And you can sort of see sometimes when people are like, ah, okay, you know, fair enough, not that interesting. But then other times, you know, like when I was working on this, you start sort of saying, oh, I'm writing about a psychiatrist in the 60s who thought some people could see the future. I normally wouldn't really be able to get past that before people are just off telling me about, you know, their experiences in their life or in their family's experience or the thing they heard in the barbershop the other day. And people's lives and people's family lives, I think, carry a lot of these stories and experiences that people don't really know what to do with. There is no explanation for them. And yet they have changed them in some way or marked them in that way, some way. Maybe they made a decision as a result of it or didn't make a decision as a result of it. Or I, like, even though there isn't an adequate, real explanation for these happenings, because we're people, because we're human, they still affect us and change us. Do you see the sort of distinction that I'm drawing?
No, I do. And, like, you know, completely, it is, because, like I say, I'm two people in that I, you know, I want to kind of go, well, you know, this, the thing is, like, so a lot of the Abervan predictions, obviously, they came out after the event. And so people might be lying. They might have convinced themselves that happened. You know, when my first date with my wife and, who would be my future wife, I kind of had a very, and she was with someone else, but I had a very strong feeling we were going to be together and we were going to have two kids, which we did have, but it was as much a hope, I guess, as a reality. And I wonder how much subsequently I've rewritten that. It was something I didn't say, it was something I thought and something I had to stop myself saying, because it's not a great first date. We're going to have two kids. But you know, how much of that actually, for example, the girl in Abervan, the girl who died in Abervan, who on the morning her mum said, she came down and said, I'm not scared of dying, and also I've had a dream about being at school and it being covered in blackness, and some words to that effect. You know, you don't know whether, you know, that mother's been through a very emotional experience. She might have not necessarily misremembered, but pieced things together in a different way, or even the event might not have happened. Similarly, I mean, this is just all the cynical things you could, you know, what a cynic would say. Similarly, if everyone's slightly, half the people were very worried about the coal tip and half the people would say they weren't. And obviously, if that was in the air, then kids were probably going to have dreams about things going wrong. Just that's the nature of humanity, right? So it's easy after the event to say, this is, that prediction came true. And they also, I thought with a lot of the plane crash ones that seem pretty strong, there's also lots of detail in those predictions that wasn't in the actual event. There were sort of 6 plane crashes a year at that time as well. So you were pretty likely to, if you said there's going to be a plane crash, you were pretty likely to get it, right? Do you think they're closer?
I'll just tell you my thoughts while you're kind of, you know, pointing out these things. You know, like, you know, obviously we're talking about confirmation bias here and people seeing things after the fact. And, you know, this happens particularly with, you know, with dreams. We dream all kinds of junk and then we sort of pick out the one telling detail, and our brains very efficiently discard all the other actual stuff that the dream was about in order to kind of come up with the thing which prefigured, you know, the person stepping into your path, you know, the next day. Like, no question at all. I think other things that I've thought about are, you know, and Abervan is particularly kind of horrifying, but also kind of full of these questions. One is just the simple human need to try and make sense of experience, right? You know, we have, you know, horrendous disasters of all kinds. And, you know, we saw this a little bit at work at the onset of the pandemic. You know, we get the full range, don't we, from kind of conspiracy theories to this was a completely unforeseen, unprecedented. How many times do we hear the word unprecedented in the space of 6 months? Do you know what I mean? Whereas, in fact, there's another highly, you know, painfully rational reading of it. It was like, oh yeah, this was the like number one threat to like the British economy and national security was, you know, a respiratory disease pandemic. Like, it's there in all the papers. So you can, it becomes, I think, a highly personal sort of way of processing events is, do you tell yourself there was no way this could have been stopped, or do you sell this as, look, human error, this was sitting right there in front of us. If we had just put the connections together better, we would have made an accurate prediction about the likelihood of this thing, ranging through to someone else is in control of everything, our lives are predestined, there is a shadowy conspiracy, you know, brewing up, you know, COVID-19 and laboratories everywhere. Do you know what I mean? It's kind of interesting.
I do, yeah.
Within our recent life to see, and you can see exactly the same thing at work in Abervan. And one of the, you know, the people I was so pleased to talk to is this American photographer, Chuck Rappaport, who some of his photographs are in the book, and who's been an astonishing kind of witness to what happened in Abervan in 1968, and actually since then, and showing his photographs in Merthyr Tydfil and Wales. He's a really wonderful man, but he was fascinating to talk to because he was 29 years old, American, go-getting photographer who just jumped on a plane, a complete fish out of water, in this village. And while we were talking, he would say, look, the community just split in all these ways. Some people said, you know, oh my goodness, how could such a, you know, incredibly tragic thing happen here, the complete, like, it came out of thin air. And other people saying, you know, my God, I've been writing to the coal company and writing to our MP and writing to local council for years, warning of exactly this thing. And people having, you know, going through the same experience will think very differently about how foreseeable it was and how much of their life is down to chance and how much of their life is in a sense already preordained.
But I suppose with a tragedy like that, it was, you know, it was preventable. It was sort of inevitable, not necessarily that it happened while the school had just opened, which was obviously a huge tragedy of it. But, you know, I wonder if there's an element of, because it was predictable in a sense, that the fact that it didn't get stopped and they stopped it and that it wasn't outwardly predictable, that I wonder if that made this, you know, the premonition side of things all the more kind of appealing, but also made them happy. You know, we should have seen this coming, but we didn't see it coming. So here's an example of, you get what I'm saying?
No, I think you've got so many things at work all at the same time. And obviously this kind of unbearable pain that, you know, 114 of the people who died were children, and some of the most, you know, convincing or haunting premonitions were from children, and children do have this kind of uncanny kind of openness, don't they? That we don't really know what's coming out of their mouths. Are they kind of less hidebound and more porous, or are they just sort of, you know, as Chuck Rappaport said of the girl Errol Mae Jones, who had that, you know, terrifying nightmare of school, you know, was she just trying to say it to get out of school? People even at the time kind of heard these things very differently. I think from my point of view, kind of researching it and writing it, thinking about Abervan, it was one of the, you know, the central questions of the tribunal, which was assembled really pretty soon after the accident. They were up and running, giving hearings and taking, you know, a judge-led inquiry, you know, 6 weeks after the disaster, and had the report all done by the following February. And one of the central questions is, was this foreseeable? And that report makes completely fascinating reading for its very human treatment of the fact that this was, of course, foreseeable and preventable, and yet previous landslips that had happened just infrequently enough that people kind of forgot about them or thought that they probably wouldn't happen again, or people's divided their realities and competences. You know, the guys piling up the waste didn't think it was their responsibility to think about how it might fall down the mountain again, because that wasn't their job. And it's actually very eloquent on lots of the things that we're talking about right now.
Yeah. It is, you know, it's all very fascinating, and I think the history in this book is as interesting as any kind of the whether premonitions are true or not. I mean, and that's And, you know, and I think you leave it very open-ended, so it's it, so you can make up your own mind about stuff like that. My son, the other day, we were in Pizza Express, and a couple came in, and so my son's usually very friendly. A couple came in and sat at the next table, and the woman was very heavily pregnant. And just my son turned to them and said, "Why aren't you married?" And my wife looked, and the woman didn't have a wedding ring. And it was so out of character of my son that it kind of felt you had to interpret going, he's been possessed by the ghost of some 19th century religious figure who's noticed that, because it was sort of such a weird, you know, he can't possibly have noticed that she wasn't married and, you know, noticed the ring. And it was such a weird thing to say. So you also start to, you know, you can do it both ways. You can sort of go, well, that's nonsense, or you can start to project things on there that aren't necessarily there, because kids just say a load of mad stuff. I also think with the all the psychics that were gathered together to go on the David Frost show to discuss this, or who all turned out to be too kooky looking to be on TV, none of them had had a premonition that they wouldn't be on the show, so they didn't need to bother going. So, and similarly, no one. And the hospital you mentioned that Tabaka worked at, Shelton, was at the centre of a quite tragic fire as well, which again, none of the premonition bureau people picked up on, supposedly. So it's a very random random thing, random power these people have. But I think it still is. It is very. There's something about it. I think you even when it is, even though it would mean the world is a very different place to what it is, and yeah, either time run concurrently and we can see everything, or the future is ultimately completely predictable. There's a part of you that just wants this stuff to be true, and that's, I think, that fuels it, doesn't it? And so I think that's what's interesting about this. It was that mixture of science and the journalistic spirit of the Evening Standard, Guy Fairley, to make a story out of it and sell papers out of it. It's an endlessly fascinating subject.
Oh, well, yeah, no, I mean, thank you, but I mean, I think that I was, in a way that anecdote about them kind of nearly getting on the David Frost program kind of summed up a lot of the story, or at least the kind of the atmosphere of it for me. Do you know what I mean? It was this turning that we didn't quite take, if you know what I mean. It just hovered on the edge of mainstream thinking just for a minute. Do you know what I mean? And maybe this was a sort of a moment where some of this thinking got as close as it ever has done. And it's been a lot of fun to me to bring that to life. I also, you know, on this kind of yearning for this stuff to be true. I mean, I find talking to people about this story, and I mean, this slightly sort of weird situation at the moment where quite people, you know, email me their premonitions now, that there are quite a few people who carry these kind of very knotty, impossible seeming events in their lives, and they just kind of don't know what to do with it, because it doesn't connect to a rational explanation of the world, and yet you have this experience. So, what do you do with that? And maybe kind of in earlier periods in our history, when, you know, these things would be absorbed into, you know, religious forms of thinking, but by saying these things aren't possible, then they just sort of sit there, and things like the Premonitions Bureau, you know, act as this kind of this outlet and a way of sort of talking about it. I'm kind of another sort of thing that I've sort of found useful to think about is J.B. Priestley wrote this book called Man and Time in 1964, where he talked about the kind of the modern notion of time, 1 second, you know, following on remorselessly after each other until the, you know, until we die. He called it like the work we live with the worst understanding of time that people have ever had. We're just talking about earlier societies being full of kind of cyclical natures of time, or kind of more porous ways in which the future or the past could kind of meet each other as actually being a more, you know, in a way, a more livable existence.
Great. I listened to the audiobook, which is great. Julian Ryan Tutt, is there a reason you didn't do the audiobook yourself?
No one asked me. But I did ask for Julian Ryan Tutt, so I'm really, really happy that he was able to do it. And I think he did a wonderful job.
Yeah, it's very good. It's a really brilliant book, and like I say, there's much more to it than just premonitions, and you get a real snapshot of a time in history as well, which I really like. And yeah, and I love the little digressions, and I love the jumping back and forth in history, which is perhaps significant, that's how the world is, we don't know. Is there any books that you're reading at the moment that you would like to recommend, as this is a book club?
I'm reading a book of short stories called Reward System by a writer called Jem Calder, and they're kind of short stories, quite kind of millennial, quite kind of a little cold, a little sort of dominated by technology, but I'm finding them really, really gripping.
Terrific. It's been really great to talk to you, Sam, and I really recommend the book, The Premonitions Bureau. I think it's doing very well. It's in the window of Waterstones in Hitchin, that's all I can tell you, so it must be
always a good sign.
It must be doing pretty well. The people of Hitchin have spoken. Thank you so much for coming on, and
thank
really
you,
love to meet you
it.
And also, and thanks to Chris Evans as always for producing and directing. I mean, not very well today because it's been quite difficult to get through, but we can't blame him for that. Thank you, Sam.
Okay, cheers, Richard.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Thanks very much for listening to the podcast. Go to GoFasterStripe.com for fantastic downloads and books, and to join the Go Faster Stripe Club and get loads of stuff from really interesting comedians. Help little Chris Evans knock that one out. That would be lovely. All right, RichardHerring.com for all my gigs. Hope to see you at a gig. Come and say hi after if you've enjoyed these podcasts. Don't come if you haven't enjoyed them and say you haven't enjoyed them. It'll make me feel sad.